don't know if it's right.
I know it's not right. The slides are going to talk. Let's see. We're still getting our act together, but that seems to be something humans spend lifetimes doing. I'm Hugh Daniel. I manage the Linux Free Spawning Project, which is IPsec and related technologies for Linux. Richard Briggs, who's sitting to my right fighting a dead machine at the moment.
HDA, lost interrupt.
Yeah, he's losing battle pretty bad at the moment. Richard is supposed to be the primary presenter here, but he's got problems at the moment. Richard is our kernel hacker who does the kernel level work in IPsec plan for the Free Spawn project. And today we're going to. I need this. There. And today we've got a double session here where we're going to try to explain to you what IPsec is, and then we're going to show to you how it works in the Linux environment, at least how our implementation works. It's going to be a little interesting song and dance, Good Cop, Bad Cop, Abbott and Costello. Originally, Richard got on the program, and he was going to do this alone, and then it was realized that not being a public conference where I was presenting, I would have to keep rather mute. There's something about my lords in Washington passing laws against my speech to you subhuman foreigners out here in the free world. And so we put me on the program. And then last week, Richard and I got on the phone to each other and said, well, let's figure out what we're going to do. And then I stopped dead cold, realizing that it was illegal for me to plan the presentation legally with the person I was going to give it with, because of the U.S. U.S. declarations, they're not laws, on cryptographic speech. So we actually haven't done much preparation as far as how our two speeches are going to mesh. But since we've stolen slides from each other over the years and stuff like this, it'll probably work out pretty well. Most of my presentation, as you might tell, comes from the SANE conference, which is a system administration conference in Europe that I gave back in May. And Richard's stuff is more or less been completely rewritten. And you might even get to see it because it looks like his disk came back to him. You don't need to know any of that. Well, the important thing here to look at is our website. It's fairly obvious. It's www.freeswan.org. And the last statement is very true. I'm not a cryptographer. I won't even play one on TV. What our team is doing, Richard and Henry Spencer, our chief architect, and Hugh Riedelmeyer, as well as our other team members, is something that there's no real good term for. I kind of think of it as cryptographic plumbers. There's very brilliant people out there who've developed the IPsec technologies over the last few years. And what we're doing is we're trying to take those technologies and put them into practice. And to do this, you don't need to be a cryptographer, but you do need to be appropriately paranoid. And one of the things we're going to talk about again and again, certainly over the first hour or the first half of the presentation, is how to be appropriately paranoid. The way I actually think of this is cryptographic hygiene. One of the things that we all learn when we're very young is, well, okay, hackers when we're a little older, is how to wash behind our ears and brush our teeth every day. And really, in setting up secure systems in the future, in the very near future, hopefully, on the net, you'll have to learn the same sort of cryptographic hygiene things, except now, instead of brushing your teeth every day, it's keeping your secret key secret and not setting up networks that are poorly designed. My talk, such as it is available at this URL. The cute slides, the HTML slides for my site, aren't finished. I have been that busy running around Europe. You're several minutes away, aren't you? Oh, sure, we can go back. That's what HTML is all about. There we go. Yeah, Theodore, we could use the XT3 up here at the moment. We both crashed at the beginning of this presentation. Our two talks are somewhat similar. I'll just kind of do an outline by gosh and by gum, in that both Richard and I spend about the first half of our talk going over what are the basics, what is the technology, why do you do it, how do you do it, how do you do paranoid stuff. It's really a technological introduction and talking about the proper mindsets for approaching things. The second half of the talk gets much more technical, where we start showing you how systems actually work, how you actually configure FreeSWAN to talk to other systems. I have a page on how you make a Cisco box talk to a FreeSWAN box, and where you get the secret hidden software from, or at least how to find out what the version number is. For Cisco's, not for us, of course. Let's see. And then hopefully if we ever get IP conductivity in here, we'll end showing you some live demos of what it takes to understand the output of FreeSWAN and actually look at it in operation. In the middle there, in the middle of the technical stuff, we'll also talk about how you set up systems, what the possible systems you could set up are, and I'll jump up and down a bunch and try to describe to you why you should go dig up five machines, put them in a room on a single desk, and set up a sandbox test system before you try to do this in the real life. Because what we are doing here is fairly different from what you're used to. I hope that you've had a chance to write down the URL yet. If you haven't, oh well. Okay.
No, it will be LinkedIn soon.
LinkedIn. Oh yeah, we'll have to add a. We're getting enough talks of the various members that we need to do something from the head web page at freeswan.org. Once again, my slides are for a slightly different group because this is morning instead of afternoon. There's enough of you here that I'm going to ask that people raise hands. As far as I'm concerned, we'll take questions about related stuff anytime during the session.
And if you could please use the microphone that's on the
projection table.
Because we're trying to record.
Could you move the microphone so it's not sitting in the fan?
Yeah, lower shelf.
Big win, big win. Although this isn't true for Richard, I'm an American, and I intend to be an American, and I intend to use that history, and I'm going to have opinions, and they're my opinions. They're not yours, but you'll probably see mine shining through this entire talk. On the other hand, my opinions is not what the talk is about. It's about how to make this stuff work. And the last one doesn't apply here particularly. So I'm kind of curious what the crowd is that we have here. At SANE, I expected lots of system and network admins, network designers, security officers, and even activists, people who are starting to use computers for NGOs. I'm curious how this group might differ. How do you folks think that you're different? What categories do you think you fall under? How many people here think they're kernel developers? One, two... Okay, how many people here think they're Linux application developers? Evolution, applications that run on top of Linux specifically. Okay, a fair number of application developers. The reason I'm asking these questions is that it helps to tailor our talk to our audience, and hopefully it helps you more than us. I will state right out front here, and actually I think it's in a slide or two, that the entire suite of protocols is not done. And one of the things that isn't done is there isn't an API for you folks at the application layer to know what's going on deep down in the bowels of the system. And there does need to be a layer there eventually because, hold on to your seats, every single networking application in existence in Unix, and especially on Linux, has to be rewritten with crypto and security in mind in the next 5 years. Period. All the Berkeley stuff, as dear as it is to some of us, has to get thrown out. It's all got to go. And things are going to look a lot different once we get serious security out there. For instance, there will be no default route. Every single host you talk to will have a specific entry in the routing table. Okay? The universe is going to change, and there's damn good reasons for this.
Are you expecting manufacturers to espouse your philosophy about that?
I'm expecting manufacturers to claim that they agree with this philosophy because they want to make the sales. Whether or not they actually hold to the line is another question.
Do they recognize what your
Some do. Let me give you an example. One of the reasons the Berkeley suite has to go is we have to dump FTP. Why do we have to dump FTP? Because one of the things FTP does is it asks for a password. And about once every 6 months, one of my guys just, you know, his brain farts, and instead of doing an SCP, he does an FTP, and it asks for his password, and he types in his SSH key passphrase in across the internet, across 2-3 continents, with at least 5 echelon stations listening in the middle. Yes, exactly. Okay, and then we have to go flush all the passwords on the system, and if we were really paranoid, we'd have to flush all the binaries along with it. Okay? And I really am kind of paranoid. So this is an example of why these things have to go. And if you're really going to do security correctly, what you end up having to do is the default route actually is wired into your policy engine for who do I talk to encrypted, who do I not talk to at all, et cetera, et cetera. Right? And then once you've decided, am I going to talk to the site, you put in a routing entry in your routing table. And that completely changes the assumptions you make in routing. And eventually, of course, this ends up in every single IP stack in the world, in every single IPv6 stack, including, thank you, Nokia. Nokia, just a month and a half ago, got the GSM consortium to say that GSM, I know most of you don't have real cell phones, but in the rest of the world besides North America, they've got real GSM cell phones, and the third generation of phones, we're on the second now, will all have IPv6 addresses, which is phenomenally good for us on the net. But also IPv6, if they're going to do it according to spec, each one of those has to have IPsec in it. And that means they're going to have to work and think differently than we're used to now. So far, manufacturers have jumped on the bandwagon because it's become a required checklist item. Whether or not they're going to really understand what that means in the long run is a little tough. I don't really care. I'm building systems for people. We can always design a better phone, can't we? Yeah. I will point out that the IETF, which is the standards body that all this stuff happens in, has made an official position that we don't care what any little pipsqueak government in North America, and that's not yours, or anywhere else in the world, wants to legislate on the technology front. We have to make the network right. And when we make a security protocol, it has to be secure. And that's primary. That's more important than little governments' worries about creating little empires, which are always temporary, as history has taught us.
Do you have an RFC for that? 1984.
1984 is actually not that particular one that I was referencing. But, yeah, 1984 is a very, very good reference for that. Let's see. How many people here are from ISPs?
Past or present?
Present. I mean, you know, why you're here and what you're pushing. Okay, just a few. Any other categories that people think they might, that I should be falling?
Network designer.
You're a network designer?
Okay.
Same.
Security officer.
Well, you already listed there, sir. Okay, so there's nothing else new here, particularly. Academics. There's a good one. How many here are from universities? Okay. What are all you university people here looking for? Why are you here? Oh, I want to see these people.
FTP replacement.
FTP replacement.
No, seriously.
Yeah?
We are turning Telnet off August 28th.
That's not FTP.
I understand that.
Good.
And the reason we're turning Telnet off is because we've got an adequate replacement for all the platforms we have to support.
Why can't you use SCP?
On Windows? On Macintosh? Don't think so.
Sure. Yes. Java, if you want to.
There's a Java implementation. Not that I'd allow Java on any of my machines, but...
Some of the machines that we're supporting simply can't support the Android and Java.
Okay.
We have a lot of old Macs where a Mac-native binary works just fine.
So no one's done Napster or Gnapster for Lackintosh?
I guess.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And there have been several suggestions. Something like SFTP, if actually implemented on multiple platforms, would be perfectly adequate. Actually, that would be great.
Mm-hmm.
But to my knowledge, such a beast doesn't exist.
Okay. Other things, maybe more IP related. thank you. I mean, you know, that it's good to let you get that out in public, and I agree, but it's not really what we're going to be doing here today. Okay. Well, I'm going to go on. Richard, how close are you to getting to do your dog and pony?
I'm ready.
You're ready? Yeah. Do you want to take over from me, or shall I?
Sure, if you want.
Okay. We'll try going back and forth on this and see how badly the projector breaks. I mean, how that works for you. Yes?
You should really say that his FTP problem is solved by IPsec if he does FTP over IPsec.
I hate to do that. Because it's so easy for that to break, but sure, I'll give an example. I had a machine break that only had a telnet port open, and unfortunately it shared a master password with a bunch of other machines, and I hemmed and hawed about this for about 20 minutes to half an hour, and then realized that all the network connections between me and that machine happened to be IPsec encrypted. And I was even able to quickly test this out, doing a trace route across the entire United States. There were two hops, which was a clear sign that my security gateway and the other security gateway were working correctly. And so I was able to use Telnet and go in securely in that case. The problem with this is you notice that I, being an expert, even had to double check. And it took me 20 minutes to go, oh, yeah, that's secure. Until we get the entire Internet secured, that isn't really a very good option as far as security is concerned, because it's just too easy to screw up. And what we're trying to do is make things that aren't easy to screw up. One of the problems with Unix, and especially Linux, is how brittle it is. And I don't really suggest that has a solution, but inside certain spaces it might be. I thought you had another mic.
That's for the video.
The video?
See the video camera?
Oh.
See the blinking red light? That's not blinking. Something like that. This thing likes to be straight, so I'm going to do that.
Okay, everyone sit still. Say cheese.
All right. So as Hugh's already said, I'm Richard G. Briggs. I actually live here in Ottawa and do the kernel programming stuff for FreeSwan. Here we go. That's a rough outline of my talk, which we're going to try and merge with Hugh's talk.
It's two talks for the price of one.
First, we'll go through some theory and standards, which is general to IPsec, not necessarily specific to FreeSwan, although there's a couple of references in it. And then go on and talk about specifically FreeSwan and go through a setup example, and we'll actually do a live demo, and if we have any time, we'll actually try and get some people.
We'll do a live demo only if we get live IP.
Yeah. If somebody can convince Jamal to put an AP closer to this room, then we may be able to actually get some people with laptops onto the net using FreeSwan. Yeah, I've sort of alluded to it already. Hugh's already alluded to it. Okay. Briefly go through looking at difference between authentication and encryption and how denial of service fits into our picture. Different levels, different, I guess, levels of security. How would I say levels? Intensities of security, if you will. Then go through the different system layers for an IPsec machine, or an IPsec setup at least. Go through some of the network shapes, the different types of networks that we have to deal with, and what types of links that we're trying to secure. Look at the difference between tunnel and transport mode, which is fairly important for IPsec use. Look at the authentication header, which authenticates packets between two machines. Now, don't be mistaken with user authentication. This is simply between machines that you trust. And then looking at the encapsulation security payload, which is the encryption header. I'll get to that when I get there. Looking at authentication and encryption, for those people who aren't completely clear on the concept, let's compare this to sex. With no authentication and no encryption, this would be similar to having sex with a stranger in a public place. Everybody can see what you're doing, and you're not really sure who you're doing it with. If this happens with your spouse in a public place, then, well, you know who you're dealing with, but everybody can still see what's going on. When we add one dev, throw a blanket on top of that.
Well, that's a lot of protection.
When we add the Clipper chip that the U.S. was trying to push for a while, then you end up at home with a government video camera and a black tape over the recording light. When you go to 3DES, then it's more like a private home, no connecting walls, blinds shut, you know, enough space so that you've actually got some privacy, and people have to actually make it a little bit more obvious that they're trying to see what you're doing. And then, of course, with your spouse, well, you actually know who's involved. And with a denial of service, if you're actively being distracted, you won't be very reproductive. Now, in terms of levels of security, if you're sending stuff on the internet, it's much like sending a postcard. As it goes through the postal system, anybody can pick it up and go, oh, they're in Greece. They're having a good time. When you go to PGP, it's like having a sealed letter where it's a little bit more obvious if somebody has actually read your email. And in fact, that isn't a very accurate analogy, because if somebody has read your email, then they're not likely to disclose that to you, because that's a passive attack. It would be closer to somebody actually trying to spoof or change some data in your email in a PGP signed email, in which case the signature doesn't check out, and then you go and look at it and go, okay, something's changed. I better not trust this. And then SSH or SSL, more like a daily corporate FedEx where you're trusting your carrier, and there's a more, intimate relationship with your carrier rather than being the postal system. And then when you go to IPsec, it's more like an intercity armored Brinks truck where there's a lot more involved in trying to get to whatever you're transporting. In terms of system layers, there's three different layers of the IPsec system. You first need to establish trust between the endpoints, which, as I pointed out before, is not user authentication, but machine authentication. So there's several ways we can do this. We started off using a pre-shared secret key, which is an ASCII string or a hexadecimal string. And then from there, we went to RSA keying. So we produce a private public key pair and distribute the public key, and then the people that we're talking to use that public key to initiate conversations with us or to verify conversations that we've initiated with them. And then ultimately we want to go to DNSSEC, and there's some preliminary support in 1.5 for DNSSEC, where it'll go to a DNS server and pull a public key record from that and start using it to talk to the other end.
How do you prevent DNS poisoning if somebody substitutes the public key? A private key.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I can answer that. The idea is that you have a DNSSEC chain that starts, for example, we go to, liberty.freeswan.org, and Liberty has a key, and then we go to the freeswan.org domain, and that has a key that has signed Liberty's key, and then you go to the org domain, and it has a key that has signed the freeswan key, and then you go to the root domain, and it has a key that signed the org domain, and you check that chain of trust right to the top. Now, this creates a problem because you need to trust the root.
Well, you don't actually have to just trust the root. One of the things
that we have assured the buying people are going to do is that you'll be able to say, here's a key for Toad.com that I trust. Don't worry about following the chain further than this. All right, so you don't have to get .com to sign Toad, to trust Toad, if you've manually inserted the Toad key into the correct configuration file in Bind. This will let us get things going in the near term. We're also beginning some tests. Sometime this fall, we're going to start a new domain in the Netherlands called NL. So it'll be NL.NL. And it's a domain that's intended to exist only for a year, where we're going to try to get the entire nation a national infrastructure of secure DNS up and running. Secure DNS does two things differently from normal DNS, fundamentally. It does key distribution, so that, for instance, whenever you ask for an A record or an AAAA record, you'll get a key record if one exists. So that's different from normal DNS, and that gets you the keys. The other thing it does is it signs records domains, as he was talking about. It signs pieces of records, and then you can follow those chains back at least towards a root, if not all the way to dot. There will be a single key to sign the entire DNS called dot. And that key actually exists. IANA had it. Presumably ICANN has it deep in a dark vault somewhere at this point.
But if they manage to poison dot, the root, they could basically lie to any...
There's a fundamental problem in net technologies that we've learned in the last 10 years, and that is that we kept wimping out now and then and designing hierarchies into various net technologies like DNS, like IP address assignment. Some of us in the ITF have learned our lesson, and we're looking at how you design future technologies that do not have these hierarchies. The problem with the hierarchies is hierarchies attract evil sharks.
Yes.
And as we can see with NSI and stuff like this, they're really screwing up the net. A pogrom that I'm beginning to go on is a pogrom against Aaron and others who claim there's an IP address shortage. There isn't an IP address shortage, and certainly not with IPv6 on the horizon. But Aaron, at least here in the Americas, is charging $20,000 a year for the minimum IPv6 block. Okay, and that's going to kill IPv6, if anything will. All right, so there never was a shortage. And what's worse is now we're getting people who are designing protocols not to work to IP addresses, but to work through masqueraded and NATed ports. And that's going to really mess things up when it comes to security, among other things. So we're looking at how to solve these problems. And yes, the whole DNS could be poisoned, but that's one of the reasons we put in the ability for you to at least stop having to walk the tree for your trusted hosts, for your trusted domains. For instance, you know, you might trust Toad.com. Certainly Toad.com will put its key up, its public key up, for downloading so that anyone can put their key or our key in their database of trusted keys. They don't have to walk any further. It's also a performance optimization, blah, 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 blah. Yes, the problem exists. We're doing what we can to avoid it, and we're also looking at what to do in the future to not have these sort of problems.
It'll be done, just not that.
That's why we're still breathing. We've got work to do.
Next layer. Once you've figured out who the endpoints are and have some way of trusting the information from it, then you want to set up some keys. The way that we started off with was manual keying. So you generate a key for each side, both an encryption and an authentication key, and then you distribute it through some secure means. Now, this doesn't mean FTP. This doesn't mean Telnet. One of our team members has actually done that and then very quickly realized what they did and turned around and erased them and generated new keys. Right. So generate a key, we use SSH or PGP to get the keys around, and then you bring up the key, the two sessions manually. That's not necessarily it's a good way to get things started and to test stuff, but in the long term it's not really a good idea because If you're putting a lot of traffic through it, then you're going to give people opportunity to do more analysis on that set of keys, and so you want to rotate the keys fairly frequently. The defaults right now, coming to the next line is IKE, and this came out of the Isaac KMP Oakley, and it was renamed. IKE stands for Internet Key Exchange.
Internet Key Association and Management Protocol.
Thanks. And what does that in FreeSwan is Pluto. Yesterday, Henry alluded to a number of renamings that were potential. I really wanted to have it called Dwight D, but it didn't happen.
Well, next major revision will change it to Dwight D.
And then, of course, there's Futurus, which is another key exchange protocol, which was developed, and for political reasons, the RFCs for that were blocked until the IKE stuff was published. And as Henry alluded to yesterday, the IKE specification has had fingers from a number of places, including the U.S. government. And Futurist was designed by, quote, people we trust, unquote. And so Futurist is a more minimal, simple protocol that, because of the simplicity, has fewer opportunities for bugs and other things, because a complex system is much harder to make secure. And then for protecting the actual information on the bottom layer, we use IPsec, which are the AH and ESP headers. Can you use the mic? Or can somebody hand him the mic? Tiny question.
Yeah, but it's a very far away recorder.
Yeah.
I'm just curious how that, having not read these RFCs and assuming that they're long and verbose and whatnot, could you summarize in a very brief sentence?
Very long and verbose. And the first quarter of each document spends its time justifying itself.
How these things extend beyond a simple Diffie-Hellman exchange?
Sorry, come again?
How do these protocols extend beyond a simple Diffie-Hellman key setup exchange?
Which ones? There's like
IKE or Futurus.
There's 15 different RFCs that cover this stuff.
There are two listed up there, IKE and Futurus.
Okay.
What do they do that's not Diffie-Hellman?
As far as I know, both of them use Diffie-Hellman, just in different modes or different ways. But the real expert's right there.
Real quickly, just stand near me. Ike was designed originally mostly by the NSA and by people who weren't really familiar with internet protocols or any of the experience we've gained in the last 30 years of designing internet protocols. It was also designed by spooks for spook reasons. Futurus was designed by internet people who have been around and seeped in the lessons we've learned the hard way on the net. For instance, Ike is very bad at doing Road Warrior unless you're willing to expose your who you are, expose your identities. Okay, where Futurus completely hides identities no matter what, and all that's visible is sourced and destination IP addresses. All right. So to rephrase this, Futurus, the first thing it does is a Diffie-Hellman, and everything's under there, and that's not the case in Ike. And that's obviously just bad protocol design. Okay, or let's put it this way. It's protocol design with a different purpose than security. The complexities go on and on from there. In reality, if you're really interested in finding out about this, Corner, Hugh Riedelmeyer, will you stand up? Okay. Quick, get your slings and arrows out. This is Hugh Riedelmeyer. He is the team member responsible for Pluto, which is the thing that does Ike negotiations for FreeSwan. And he knows far too much about this, and he'll scream and rant about how horrible it is, but he's the person who knows the details. Let's...
Right. So in terms of RFCs and protocols, the ones that we're dealing with here, well, there's several different layers. DNSSEC has a set of specifications. IKE has a set of specifications. Forturis has a set of specifications. AH has its set of specifications, and so does ESP. So the whole suite of protocols we're looking at, when you take into account all of the related stuff, including HMAC, which is a way of using hashed, message digests, secure message
authentication.
Sure. And all of this, the different hashes and ciphers and methods of applying them and chaining and the whole bit, you're looking at 25, 30 RFCs. I mean, it gets a little out of hand. One of the next slides is lists all of the RFCs.
But they're all really real.
Excuse me.
Surely you jest. Okay, there's a number of different types of network shapes that we need to deal with. Each has its own special features and challenges. Starting off with the classical VPN, which would be you have a branch office and you want to talk to maybe head office or maybe two peer offices or however you've set up your network, or you've got some guy at home with a small network and you want to connect up to some other friend who's got another small network at his place, so you want to connect the two, dream up whatever you want to do, where you want to use the internet as a common carrier, but you want to keep all of that information secure. And what this can do is hide the...
Keep the information private is a better term. Secure means too much.
Okay.
Freeform's really good right now at doing privacy.
Okay, keep the information.
What does VPN stand for?
Sorry?
What does VPN stand for?
Details. Virtual private network. Right, and so what it can do is it can hide the architecture of the networks that are behind the gateways so that anybody who's sniffing in between has no idea what the architecture is. All they can really do is do traffic analysis and look at the size of packets and the frequency and maybe glean some information from that. And even to the point of people might argue that stuffing a news feed through an IPsec link is a waste of bandwidth, but CPU bandwidth. But there are definite advantages to doing this because this prevents traffic analysis by having so much stuff going through there that it's hard to pick out the real gems from the routine garbage that's just floating around the internet.
That would be true if we had IP comp running and we were doing size blocking, but we're not at the moment.
You guys looked into doing something like CDNA where it's constant data is coming out at the other end, so we want to figure out that nothing's actually being sent.
Yes, I thought about playing those games, but I'm much more interested in making the system work top, what I call the vertical slice of all the problem space. And that's not really a required part of that solution. So that's a nice toy that I'd like to do, but haven't had time to play with personally. Plus, if I did it, you couldn't have the code because you're not an American.
Zero Knowledge is very knowledgeable about this technique.
There's two different techniques. There's building a mix, which is what Zero Knowledge is doing.
Mm-hmm.
And there's doing essentially what you might call cloaking packets.
Well, but they're also filling their packets.
Well, that's a base technology for both approaches.
Just a quick point out. In terms of classical VPN, the H1 and H2 are hosts. They could actually be host subnets on either end, where you could have anywhere from one to a class A behind it. Then you've got a security gateway, you'll have a router, then you'll have the big bad internet, goes to another router, and then to the security gateway on the other end. Everything with an equal sign in the middle is a IPsec connection. And so if you do a trace route from H1 to H2, you're going to see H1, SG1, SG2, H2. That's it. The rest appears as a leased line, and it's not visible from... The rest of the internet's not visible from either of the end hosts. Okay. Next, we've got a degenerate case of a VPN. And into that, we've thrown some randomness where the road warrior doesn't really know what its address is going to be the next time it connects to the net. And so you want the SG2 to be able to figure out who it is the next time it connects. And so rather than using an IP address to identify your expected connections, then we use other heuristics. We use machine names, which are not necessarily DNS resolvable. And within that, we also use the identities of RSA public keys. So what happens then is you end up tunneling from your road warrior through the big bad internet to a gateway, and you're able to see the subnet behind that, which the rest of the internet is not necessarily able to see. You could do host-to-host. Either one of them could be a road warrior, but not both. And this is essentially just to do, again, a degenerate case of where you're talking to the gateway rather than a big subnet behind it. Extruded subnet's an interesting one because you may want to get some group of addresses to another part of the internet, and there's people out there who don't necessarily want you to have that. So what you can do is you can use that to export these addresses to another place. Now, you could use IP-IP tunneling to do this, but then they would know what you're doing. So if you throw all of this stuff into a tunnel, then whoever's trying to figure out what you're doing can't. So instead of having the internet in the center, you could have the internet on one end. Now, what's actually going on, what could actually be going on, is that you could be going from host to the security gateway through the internet, and then to gateway 2, and then it folds it back into the internet. So it's actually tunneling through the internet to get to the internet. Sorry?
What's that for?
What's that for? Interesting scenario. I live here in Ottawa. I'm on ADSL, the original ADSL with static IP address. They give me one. They will not give me any more than one. If I want more than one real IP address, then I have to get them from somewhere else. I can masquerade, but that doesn't help me if I want real IP addresses that I can, you know, distribute for various machines behind me. So what I do is set up a tunnel to a friend who's got more IP routed directly to him, and then set up that tunnel so that it routes part of that tunnel, part of that subnet or an entire subnet or whatever group that you're going to export through that tunnel, so it then ends up on my gateway. Now, routing back, I could route straight to the internet, but there's routers out there that are starting to say, or ISPs that are starting to say, hey, I'm not expecting that address back there, and drop it, because they don't want people to do that, or they're trying to be proactive and saying, there's some funny stuff going on here, I'd better block it. So you just route those packets back through that tunnel, and they appear to be coming from wherever they started. Now, you can do this as many times as you want. So what I've actually done in practice is I've had some addresses tunneled to my firewall, and then I go on the road with my laptop, and I show up somewhere else, and I tunnel into that, and I export a subnet of the ones that were originally exported. So now I end up with a subnet that I can export on a second card on my laptop, and that person, when they DHCP an address from that subnet, they pop out on the net in the original place that those packets were routed.
Did that make sense?
Stay away from my university.
So what happens is you can't really be sure where the hell those machines are anymore.
This is good.
This is a good thing.
This is good. Because, yes, this is very, very good. Okay.
You debug that with a hammer and some tequila.
We've never had a problem. Seriously, it works. It works solid because all we're doing is routing. Okay, and it works cleanly. Now, this link has been up for what, over a year and a half now? Okay, the one he described.
Mm-hmm. And I just spent 9 weeks in Australia, And I was able to go and take my laptop and pull this stunt, and it worked. And I was very pleased when it just came up and it just happened. I didn't need to do it before. And
also, this is going to be hell on people who wish to filter the net and do content control and location control.
I work for a university.
Yeah, that's their problem.
It's a major requirement.
They can go to hell. Question?
I get you right. This could be used then for an anonymous user then so that you look like you're coming from the anonymous, you know, say, www.anonymous.com or something.
Well, you're not really coming from an anonymous address. It's still IP addresses. Mm-hmm.
So you're coming from someplace, like, say, for instance, Anonymizer. You use Anonymizer. They look like you're coming from Anonymizer. But there's someone who is using Anonymizer. They don't know who the heck you are because you're hidden in all the people.
It's somewhat like it, but it's not exactly the same.
You trace route. Okay, let's be honest here, okay? He gets 64 addresses from me. I'm in California, okay? His co-op, people in his co-op, Joe Average Person, look like they're in my house in California, where I happen to have a spare 64 addresses, among others.
How many beds?
How many beds? I don't have enough beds. There's, you've lost it again. Turn it off. Okay, so I'm in California. I've got 64 addresses. I export to him. Okay? Now, he hands most of those 64 addresses off to people in his co-op, and a couple of those addresses he can grab, like there's an 8-address subnet. So he's got 5 addresses that he can connect to his laptop wherever he is in the world. Okay, so that means if we're sitting in a bar in Cancun, right, and we need to have a meeting, we can hook his laptop up to a cell phone connected to his machine here in Ottawa. Right, we can then put an Ethernet and a hub on the table in the bar in Cancun, and the rest of the team can hook up to it, and we are all able to talk to each other and get our email off the net and suck down the newest RFCs we need to reference. And it all works cleanly. And the fact is that you can do trace routes and all this other stuff that you're worried about. Okay, it's just that as far as paranoids are concerned, it all looks like it's happening in California, and only someone who looks really close wonders why there's a 105 millisecond link inside my house in California. Okay, and that's the jump from California here to Ottawa. Okay, and this lets us move networking around. Basically, this is something that people haven't figured out. This is mobile IP. Okay, mobile IP isn't mobile IP. It's far more complex than this. This is mobile IP based very simply on IPsec and routing, which is much cleaner than the current mobile IP mess. And as far as tracing, there's external addresses. You know, he's still got his ISP in Cancun or whatever he's connected to.
Well, plus his bandwidth usage doubles. Mm-hmm. If he's technically using 64K and pulled down, he's got to send it and or receive it twice.
Yeah, well, I've got a T1.